Hey, good morning, everybody. Anatomy students, Bio 231, summer session. Welcome to class. And today is July 28th, and we're steaming toward the end of the class. Let's take a look at the schedule, make sure that we're all on track, or at least that your instructor's on track with things. Okay, schedule's on the right-hand side. Everything's working. So indeed, today is the 28th. We're going to start lymphatic system and get done with that. Maybe move into respiratory system. I just have probably one comment on blood vessels to remind me of something. And that's about it. Don't forget, what is your final exam?
Wednesday.
Right on. It is on Wednesday. And that is going to be August 5th, right? That's a Wednesday. Then you're almost done with the class. The last deadline in here is Friday night. Right, for that online assignment if you haven't done that already. All right, so the 28th, no lab quiz today, but a lab quiz tomorrow. Check that out. And then we got one more on Monday of next week, and then also probably some extra credit assignments will be due then. You also have a practicum on Wednesday, August 5th. All right, so a lecture exam and a practicum, give you a break in between those two. Probably as much time as you want to recuperate. And on Wednesday, August 5th, I'll be here early, at least by 8 o'clock, maybe a little bit sooner. If you want to come in, get a head start, just take the test in a more relaxed fashion, you're welcome to do that. And then you might get done early, which means you might be able to brush up a little bit on the practicum stuff. And I'll get up in to the third floor and open up the study room so you can look at those models soon. But sometimes on exam days, there are some students that are very careful and use a lot of time up. All right, so sometimes I'm not done giving the exam until maybe like 5 minutes to 10 o'clock. If that's the case, I can't get upstairs and open up that study room any sooner than that. All right, but I'll try to get up there right away. Any questions on the schedule? Remember, photo ID. Don't forget your photo ID because I can't release your grades unless I get it, and I might not see you again ever. So make sure you bring your photo ID, pencil, good eraser, and a Scantron that's nice and clean and fresh. That's all mutilated and marked up. Okay. All right. So that's the schedule. Any questions, comments about the schedule? We're pretty good. Okay. Well, we were talking about blood vessels last time. Let's look at the slide on the right. And here we see that there's basically three kinds of blood vessels with some smaller modifications of these general types. You have arteries, right, which take blood away from the heart. You got capillaries, specialized for exchange. And then veins, which bring blood back to the heart. And you know that arteries have high pressure, veins have low pressure, and a fluid will flow from high pressure to low pressure. And that's why there's low pressure in veins. If what kind of pressure is in a capillary? Just to kind of wake you guys up, what kind of pressure is in a capillary? Kind of pressure? Well, if it's high in an artery, you might think because the capillary is the significant place where physiology takes place, that that might have the lowest pressure. But you know what? If a capillary had the lowest pressure, that's where all the blood would flow into. Blood would flow into capillaries from arteries. Blood would flow into capillaries from veins, and it would never get back to the heart. All right, so veins have the lowest pressure. You might notice that the thickest blood vessel are arteries. They have elastic layers. They have much thicker muscle that surround them compared to veins. As a matter of fact, veins don't even have elastic tissue, and capillaries only have one, a simple squamous epithelium, right? And that's why it allows for exchange. Even a continuous capillary like I see one here. But don't forget about the other two kinds of capillaries. The only thing that's really significantly different from what I've talked about so far, in particular with veins, is that veins do have valves. Capillaries don't, arteries don't, but veins do. And that just makes sure that blood always flows back to the heart if these valves are healthy. Right? They're not healthy in all people. All right, so what I want to actually get your attention to is this artery. It is very thick. And look how thick this muscle wall is, right? It's very thick. And so some arteries that are large and have a very thick muscularis layer, then they have to have their own blood supply. So a blood vessel not only delivers blood to some part of your body, but there has to be a blood vessel nourishing these cells that make up a large blood vessel. And you should know what the name of those blood vessels are that are inside other blood vessels. Now, the nice thing is that there aren't any other blood vessels inside those. So it's not a blood vessel inside a blood vessel inside a blood vessel inside a blood vessel. It's only blood vessels inside a blood vessel. Okay, and here is a nice picture. I didn't go over this picture. Here's a cross-section that shows the tunica externa, tunica media, intima, right? So here's, yeah, I can see a simple squamous epithelium right here. But in the tunica externa, I do see some blood vessels here, okay, here and here. These are blood vessels. And on the slide, it also shows you what the name is. These blood vessels are called the vasa vasorum. All right, so vasa vasorum is a network of blood vessels inside of a blood vessel that nourish all of the smooth muscle cells and fibroblasts that make these elastic layers as well. Okay, and a really good example of a conducting artery that is highly elastic is the aorta. Okay, because the aorta does expand when the heart pumps blood into it, and then when the heart relaxes during diastole, that bulge of the aorta shrinks back down, and that maintains pretty much a constant flow of blood through the aorta, right? Because these elastic fibers will just return the shape of the aorta down to its resting diameter. Okay, so that's vasa vasorum. Any questions about that? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so vasa vasorum are blood vessels that nourish the wall of other blood vessels, in particularly large arteries. Because these arteries are so thick, even though there's nice oxygenated blood in this artery, it can't diffuse into these layers, these deeper layers inside of a blood vessel because they're so thick. And then these cells would die, and that's terrible when some part of a blood vessel dies. Right? Then it could blow out, cause a stroke or whatever. Okay, so that's it. So let's move on to lymphatic system. And here's lymphatic system. Do I have something open? What's this right here? That's still the blood vessel. Okay. All right, let's open up a picture of lymphatic system. All right, so we just saw that the cardiovascular system delivers fluid around throughout your whole body, and it's that fluid's called blood, and blood has a cellular component, it has red blood cells. It also has a fluid component to it, and that fluid component is what we call plasma. The fluid component of blood is called plasma. The cellular components in blood are what we call formed elements, like white blood cells and red blood cells and platelets. Okay, and this blood, whole blood, formed elements and plasma, right, will be pumped from the heart through the vascular system into an artery, past the capillary, and then return to the heart. So it's a nice complete circulatory system, right, starting with an artery, and that's what I see on this slide right here. So I see the heart pumping blood into an artery. Remember, artery takes blood away from the heart into a capillary, and then this fluid returns to the heart via a vein. So that's a typical nice cyclic circulatory pattern in a normal blood vessel or vascular system. Well, in this capillary bed, right, things can diffuse through the wall of the capillary, but remember, there's also spaces, there's fenestrations and intercellular clefts between the cells, so fluid actually leaves a capillary, right, and it leaves the blood system. So, especially at this proximal end of a capillary where there's really high pressure, that forces a lot of fluid out into the interstitial spaces, and when that does flow out, it brings nutrients to all the cells and oxygen to all the cells that fluid flows around. All right, so we have fluid leaving the cardiovascular system, and not all of it gets resorbed by the distal end of a capillary that we see right here. So some fluid remains in the interstitial spaces. And if that fluid were to remain in interstitial spaces, then our body would swell up. That swelling is what we call edema. Right, so how much fluid leaks out of all the capillaries in your body? Right, 30 liters of plasma pass out of a capillary each day. So that's a huge amount of fluid. I know I have the lights turned off, but can you tell me that water bottle right there, how many liters that is? Is that like a half a liter or a quarter of a liter? Oh, say it a little bit more. Oh, 16 ounces. It's maybe like a quarter of a liter, I think. 250 mLs probably. Okay, so what would be, we have to multiply that by 4 to get to 1 liter times 30 would be the amount of fluid that leaks out of your body compared to that thing. Okay, so what's that? That's 120 of those bottles leak out of your blood system every single day, nourishing all those tissue spaces. So you'd imagine that you could dehydrate very, very quickly. Right, but fortunately, at this distal end of a capillary, a lot of that fluid gets resorbed. 27 liters gets resorbed at the end of that capillary. So that means that 3 liters are left. And so if we didn't have a way to recover that fluid and put it back into the cardiovascular system, our body would swell up by 3 liters every day, which is what, 12 of those things, which is a pretty large volume. All right, so how does that fluid get returned to the body? This is one of the more important things about the lymphatic system. Right, that fluid gets absorbed by lymphatic capillaries. And these things are different because they don't have a supply blood vessel, like a blood vessel capillary. Right, a normal capillary gets blood from an artery, but the capillaries, the lymphatic capillaries, just soak up fluid that is around cells. And since they absorb this fluid, we call them capillaries. And then that fluid makes its way back to a vein, like the subclavian vein, and gets emptied back into the cardiovascular system so that you don't dehydrate. That's super important. Okay, and I see that there are some valves along the way because lymphatic fluid is at a very low pressure. And again, the muscle pump and respiratory pump helps move this lymphatic fluid or lymph back to the heart. And as this lymph fluid moves back to the heart, it goes through a couple checkpoints, right? And these checkpoints are what we call lymph nodes. Lymph nodes filter lymph and look for pathogens that are in lymph. Could be bacteria, viruses, fungi, other kinds of things. Could be cancer cells, for instance, can be trapped in these lymph nodes. And hopefully your immune system then can educate itself as to what these noxious particles are or infectious particles are, or infectious cells are, and develop some kind of immune response to kill the cells before they have access to the rest of your body. So lymph always has to pass through at least one node as it gets back to the heart. Okay. All right, so 3 liters a day of lymph are returned to the heart via the lymphatic system. So that's a very important function of lymphatic system. So what are some items of the lymphatic system that help return fluid to your body, but also protect your body from infection? So here is a composition of some important structures. You have lymph, which is fluid, pretty much like plasma, the fluid part of blood. You have lymphocytes, and I think you had to look at a lymphocyte in lab. That is an immune cell. It helps fight infection. All right, so lymphocyte, part of the lymphatic system. You have these lymph vessels that we've been talking about, very low pressure blood vessels that soak up tissue fluid, and that fluid has to pass through lymph nodes before it gets returned to the cardiovascular system. And then we have a couple special organs, tonsils, in your oral cavity, maybe in your throat, in the back of your oral cavity. They are there for immune response as well. They fight infection. The spleen, we're going to see where the spleen is when we get into, maybe today, or digestive system. It's not a digestive organ, but it lies very close to the stomach and the abdominal cavity, so that's kind of when we look at it. The spleen, we'll talk about that in particular, and the thymus gland. Does anybody remember where the thymus gland is? Yeah, you're pointing to it. That's wonderful. I like that. But I want to know the name of that spot. What's the name of that spot? That's cool if you know the name, because then you sound educated. All right? If you don't know the name of that spot, then, I don't know, you might miss some points on the test. Okay? What is the name of that cavity that the thymus gland is in? It's in the, yeah, it's in the thoracic cavity. I like that. But it's even in a smaller cavity. It's in a subcavity of thoracic cavity. What about pleural? What about pleural cavity? Is it in pleural cavity? No. It separates the right and left pleural cavities. What is that cavity that separates the right and left pleural cavities from each other? And I think I heard it over here. It's got a little swing to it. It's called the mediastinum. Right? Mediastinum. So thymus gland is in the mediastinum. All right. So let's zoom into this capillary, which we see right here. So I see a bunch of tissue cells, right? And there's spaces between these cells, right? And that's just the interstitial space. If this is a connective tissue, that would be called the matrix, but in many other tissues, we just call this the interstitial space. We have a lot of water in this space, as well as other nutrients that we get from stuff leaking out of a blood vessel capillary, and then that excess fluid is returned, right? So here is like a finger of a lymph vessel. That's what we call a lymph capillary, which soaks up some of that fluid, and then it makes its way back to the heart. So you can see this lymphatic system is like a network absorbing fluid all over the body. If that system doesn't work, the fluid builds up in that region of the body. All right. So as an example, someone might have a tumor, a cancerous tumor in some part of their body, and if it's a cancerous tumor, those cells like to break away from the tumor, travel through your body and go to another place and then start growing there and form another tumor in some other location inside your body, right? And that's why it's dangerous, because you can't go and get all those tumors out normally, and they'd cause damage when they start to grow, right? But your body helps protect you from these cells that are metastasizing or trying to move around in the body. If they get into the lymphatic system, right, remember, lymph passes through a lymph node, and lymph nodes can filter these cells out, and so there can be an accumulation of cancer cells within a lymph node. And that means that the lymph node will become cancerous as well, unfortunately, but that kind of retards the spread. It slows the spread of cancer down. So when somebody has a primary tumor and a physician removes that tumor, they also look for cancer cells in lymph nodes around that tumor. Right, and hopefully they don't find any. But if they do, right, then they typically just remove that lymphatic vessel and that lymph node, because you don't want any cancer in your body. And then they have to go to the next one and look and see, is there cancer in this one? And if there is, then they got to remove that one as well. And they just kind of trace it all the way to where they don't see any cancer in a nice healthy lymph node. All right, so that whole part of the lymphatic system then is removed from somebody's body, and that's kind of good because that gets rid of all those cancer cells. But what is the trade-off? What is a side effect of removing somebody's lymphatic system in some part of their body? We just talked about it. Swelling, which we call edema. There's going to be edema in that part of somebody's body. There's going to be swelling. Okay, that's just a side effect that probably we can't deal with very effectively yet. All right, so here's that valve. It looks very much like a valve that we see in a vein, right? And it's part of the endothelium that makes a lymphatic vessel. Okay, so that is all these lymph nodes. The lymphatic system is also important because when we eat lipids in our diet, our lipids are not absorbed into our body via a blood vessel. So what can you tell me about oil and water? Really important physical chemistry concept that we'll use a lot in physiology. But what can you tell me about water and oil? Do they mix easily? Right? If you're buttering a piece of toast in the morning, get some butter on your shirt, can you just get a wet paper towel and clean it up? Nope, won't happen. Right? Because oil or fats, lipids, and water just don't mix. Right? When we eat them in our diet, it's very hard for our body to absorb them and digest them because our body is mostly water. So fat is absorbed by the lymphatic system, and in particular, that little capillary that's in our digestive tract that absorbs fat is called a lacteal. They're in small intestine. They absorb fat, mixes with lymph, turns into a white milky fluid that we call chyle. So chyle is a mixture of lymph and fat, and then the lymphatic system helps process those fats, emulsifies it, breaks it down into smaller pieces so that our body can deal with it. All right, so fat absorption is also another important function of lymphatic system. All right, we talked about self-defense mechanisms, right? And lymphatic system might be the most important, certainly one of the most important organ systems in your body, because it keeps you healthy, it helps fight infection. And microorganisms are trying to gain access and take advantage of your body all the time. So your immune system has to be functioning properly. So lymph nodes filter lymph. They contain lymphocytes. Lymphocytes can educate themselves on how to fight infections. And also in lymph nodes, right, they can also tell other kinds of cells how to fight infection. Right? So, well, there's different kinds of lymphocytes that do that, B lymphocytes and T lymphocytes. Maybe I'll talk about those in a little bit. All right, so that's a lymph node, filters lymph, and then the spleen filters blood. And it does pretty much the same kind of function with some other additional functions. All right, so it filters blood of pathogens and tries to identify those pathogens and then come up with some kind of response to kill them, to get them out of your body. And the self-defense tissue in your body sometimes is a lymph node. It's a nice structure that you can see, or a spleen, which is a nice structure that you can see even without a microscope, and tonsils that are in your oral cavity, posterior oral cavity or throat. Those you can see with your naked eye, right? But there's also lymphatic tissue all over your body that doesn't really make a structure that you can see with your naked eye. They're smaller, right? They're spread out all over the place. And they're usually located in a mucous membrane of some place, right? And a mucous membrane, remember, is a membrane that lines a cavity that's open to the outside world. And since that cavity is open to the outside world, anything in the outside world can get into that particular cavity. So it makes sense that that cavity has a lot of ways to fight infection. That tissue that's spread all over your body is called mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue or lymphoid tissue. We just call it MALT. Right, so this is material that can fight infection, and we find it everywhere where there's a mucous membrane. So lymphoid tissue is a reticular kind of connective tissue. It doesn't have to be very strong, and these tissues contain large quantities of lymphocytes that can fight infection. Okay, and so where do we find it? Digestive tract, respiratory tract, urinary tract, reproductive tract. Right, and so these all have mucous membranes because they're all open to the outside world. And then the last concept about MALT is that they contain germinal centers. Okay, so and even a lymph node is a germinal center. So let's look at this word, germinal. Does anybody have a sense of what germinal could mean, germinal? Okay, sometimes in botany, they use the term germinate. Okay? When they put somebody takes a seed and they put it in a certain environment that is conducive for it to start growing, like soil and some water. All right, so when a seed starts to grow into a plant coming from a very dormant embryo that could even be dried out to a plant that's starting to grow, that process of the new growth is called germination. Right, so germination means growing. And enlarging, right? So it's like a function of mitosis, right? So mitosis causes germination. And the lymph node and all the other mucosa, all the other MALT tissues in your body are germinal centers, because when they're presented with an infectious agent, we're just going to call these things antigens from now on. Antigens are just foreign substances in your body. When antigens are presented to germinal centers, they recognize them, and then they start to grow. And they grow by producing lymphatic cells, which can fight infection. All right, so germinal center starts to grow, they get bigger, they start producing cells that can fight infection, and that protects your body. And as a matter of fact, maybe you had an infection, maybe a sore throat or something, you went to see a doctor, looked at your throat and goes, oh yeah, what a mess. All right, and then they start feeling your neck, okay, and maybe some other parts of your body, right? Because what they are trying to palpate are lymph nodes, which contain germinal centers. So he's trying to she's trying to palpate lymph nodes in your neck to see if they are enlarged, right? If they're enlarged, that means that there are immune systems that are germinating, starting to grow in that part of your body to fight an infection, which is a good thing. But that also means that your sore throat, whatever bacteria is in your throat, also is in that other part of your body, right? So that's a way to tell if you have a systemic infection or how far it has progressed to other parts of your body, or is it just localized to your throat? And maybe the treatment would be a little bit different depending on how severe that infection is, right? So a germinal center is a center that can identify antigens, and then it starts to grow to produce things that will fight that infection, right, including lymph nodes and other places all over the body, right? And spleen can do that, okay, and lymph nodes can do that. And let's move on. Lymph vessels, okay, carry lymph away from tissues back to the heart. Begins in a lymph capillary, just a nice simple squamous epithelium. Ooh, I didn't show you this picture. Let's zoom in to the tip of a lymph capillary. It has like little flaps that can open and close, and when they open, tissue fluid can enter the lymph capillary, and then when these tissues contract, for instance, then this flap closes and this tissue fluid is trapped inside of a lymph capillary and then makes its way back to the heart. So this almost acts like a little mini valve. It looks like a valve that opens and closes and allows interstitial fluid to enter a lymph capillary. All right, so lymph begins in a lymph capillary via these little mini valves right here. And then, just like blood in a vein, it makes its way back to the heart via skeletal muscle contraction, right? The skeletal muscle pump. And the respiratory pump are two ways that fluid will move back into the thorax, just like for venous blood. And the reason why that works is because, just like veins, lymphatic vessels also have these valves that looks very much like a valve in a vein. Okay, so breathing helps return lymph back to the heart. All right, so we want to look at some of the duct system that brings blood back to the heart. So here is a little ghostly man with the lymphatic system drawn in so that we can see it. And this little ghostly man, you can see, is shaded with two different colors. And notice that there is a lot of asymmetry. It's not like the right side of the body has one color and the left side has another, all right? So there is some a lot of asymmetry. So on the right side, okay, I wish I knew what that color was. Green. How about green? Who knows it's green? Yeah. So this green, this light green color right here, designates that if there is tissue fluid that is in a lymphatic vessel, okay, it goes back, okay, to the right subclavian vein, okay, via the lymphatic duct, and the lymphatic duct drains the right side of the head, the right thorax, and the whole right upper appendage, right, gets returned to the cardiovascular system this way. Okay, then, right, there is another vessel that returns lymph to the cardiovascular system or to the blood, and that vessel drains lymph from the left side of the head, the left thorax, the left upper appendage, right, and also the left abdomen, and then the whole pelvis, right and left pelvis, and then right and left lower appendages all are returned to the heart via the thoracic duct. So I think this is an exam figure, so just kind of be aware of that. There is a center area right in the abdominal cavity called the cisterna chyli, and it just receives a lot of lymph from abdominal organs, and then that gives lymph to the thoracic duct, which makes its way to the subclavian vein. Okay, any question on that? So this symmetry might be a little bit, or this asymmetry might be a little startling for you, okay? Because usually we're just aware of nice symmetry inside the body. Okay, lymph organs, other lymph organs. They contain lymphatic tissue, they can contain germinal centers, they contain lymphocytes that can fight infection. They have macrophages. Okay, so what the heck is a macrophage? A macrophage started out as a white blood cell. Okay, and that white blood cell is called a monocyte. We didn't identify those in lab, but these are shape-shifting cells. They can crawl around, they can change their shape, and they can push their ways out through capillaries, through those tiny spaces, right? And when they leave your blood vessel, right, they can still crawl around in other tissues, through tissue spaces, right? And then that monocyte becomes a macrophage, even though it was a white blood cell in a blood vessel at some point in time, and it's crawling around everywhere in your body looking for things that don't belong there. Question? Yeah, white blood cells are leukocytes, and there are five kinds, okay? In lab, we looked at neutrophil and lymphocyte. There's three more kinds that we didn't talk about. And a monocyte is one, eosinophil is another, and basophil is another. They're all pretty much involved in immune response. But that monocyte is really special because by amoeboid motion, by shape-shifting, it can crawl around through very small spaces that other cells can't fit through. So it can actually crawl out of a capillary into a tissue, into a interstitial space and then crawl around in various parts of your body, looking for things that don't belong there, right, by looking at the shape of antigens. And macrophages can identify tumors, cancerous tumors sometimes, and that's really nice when that happens because, you know what, probably we've all had cancerous tumors in our body, but we never recognized them because these macrophages identified them and killed that cell line before they ever became noticeable or a problem for you, right, because that's happening. These macrophages are working 24 hours a day, fighting infection and other kinds of things that don't belong in your body, for instance, like tumors and even cancerous tumors. And that's how come, that's one reason why we can explain why some people have a spontaneous remission of a dangerous, deadly cancer in their body. That does happen every once in a while. And for some reason, those tumor cells were able to hide from macrophages, and then something happened to where these macrophages then identified those different tumors, and then those macrophages were able to kill that particular tumor, and a person then can recover, which is pretty miraculous. It'd be nice to be able to control that in everybody that has cancer, but we don't know that much about that process yet. Okay, so these cells are in lymphatic tissue. They're in malt. They're in spleen and thymus and tonsils, for instance, okay, and malt. So where do these lymphocytes come from? Lymphocyte is a type of white blood cell or a type of leukocyte. They originate in red bone marrow, just like all blood cells originate in red bone marrow. Red blood cells are produced in red bone marrow, and then they're carried by the blood to lymphatic organs, because blood goes to all of these different organs. When you have an infection via a microorganism, right, they get trapped in a lymph node or some other kind of lymphatic tissue, and these microorganisms, and you could just say antigens, I'd probably like to use the word antigen, okay, these antigens stimulate lymphocyte cell division, right, which is mitosis. So at first you have one lymphocyte, then two, then four, then 8, then 16, so it's a nice exponential kind of growth pattern. So these germinal centers start to enlarge, and these lymph nodes can even enlarge, tonsils can become enlarged and inflamed, and so we call this immune system activation. Immune system activation happens in a germinal center when an antigen arrives at that particular lymphatic tissue, which could be malt, right, or lymph node, or tonsil, or any of that kind of lymphatic tissue. All right, so germination means growing. So what can activate the immune system? What is something that activates the immune system? It is microorganisms, and what's maybe a better way of thinking about that? Antigens, that's right. Things that don't belong inside your body can activate the immune system, and when that happens, right, then lymphocytes start to divide by mitosis. We call that germination. Where does germination take place? It takes place in germinal centers, right, which are in lymphatic tissues, like lymph nodes, tonsils, etc., etc. Okay. All right, tonsils. Don't have a picture in this chapter. We have a picture when we get to digestive system. That's a couple chapters away, all right? But we have two sets. Okay, we have two pairs of them, and then there's a third one that there's only one. Right, so we have three different kinds of tonsils in our body. We have a palatine tonsil. Those are ones that are easily observed when you open your mouth, stick your tongue out, say, ah, you can see those in the back of your throat. Then we have pharyngeal that are up in the nasal cavity. Sometimes we call those adenoids. And then there's one underneath the tongue. We call that a lingual tonsil. And they all are there to fight infection, especially microorganisms that are trying to enter your body through your nose and your mouth. So they're there to fight infection. Right? They contain MALT, which are germinal centers that can identify antigens and then start to grow, producing a lot of lymphocytes. Unfortunately, sometimes one of these organs, right, can become chronically infected. Right? Their job, they have done their job so well collecting microorganisms or antigens that they can't clear it. They can't kill all the microorganisms that they have collected. And so then that causes a sore throat. And usually it's the palatine tonsils that you can see. And if you have chronically inflamed palatine tonsils, then you might have a sore throat every other week. Might be a bad sore throat to where you can't go to work, right? And so you're missing work a couple times a month. And so your lifestyle is really bad. So not only can't you go to work, but you feel miserable. And if that's the case, and it can't be treated with antibiotics, and you know they've tried that and it doesn't clear up, well, then one option would be to remove that chronically infected tonsil, and that's called a tonsillectomy. Yeah, tonsillectomy. Okay. All right, so tonsillectomy is really good at removing that infected tissue from your body, and when somebody has a tonsillectomy, they might not have a sore throat for a year, which is amazing, right? So going from a sore throat, missing work every other week, or maybe at least once a month to not having a sore throat, it will seem like forever. That's wonderful when that happens, right? Okay, well, there's a downside to that. If you're young, right, it's a relatively easy procedure to remove the palatine tonsils. And probably that very same day, that young person is going to ask for something to eat, like ice cream for sure, Jell-O, and it's very good to have them eat something. If you're an adult, it's not such an easy procedure to undergo because your tonsils, right, are almost as big as the tip of your thumb, okay? And you have two of them on either side of your throat. So you can imagine if somebody was to go through your body and gouge out a hunk of tissue as big as the tip of your thumb, you can imagine what that would feel like, okay? It feels really bad. And I think, oh, I used to know this, but I have a hard time remembering this, but I think you get 6 weeks off of work, right? You need 6 weeks of recuperation to get over a tonsillectomy when you're an adult, which is a huge amount of time, right? You get your gallbladder removed. They probably want you to go back to work the next day or the day after that, right? So tonsillectomy is a fairly serious kind of surgery to have. So you might be wondering, gee whiz, why do I want to go through that kind of surgery? Well, you know what? Probably everybody that's had that surgery would recommend it because they hardly ever get a sore throat anymore, right? So they do that one time and it's like almost curative, right? Has anybody ever had a tonsillectomy in their adult age in here? Not too many. Anybody have a tonsillectomy when you were a kid? I didn't, but you might not remember because it's not very that memorable of a episode in your life, but it would be if you're an adult. All right, so those palatines are the ones that you see. Lymph nodes, right? So we mentioned that. It contains MALT, right? So it filters lymph. And when lymph returns back to the heart, it has to travel through at least one node, and in many cases, as many lymph nodes. Okay, there are some areas in your body that have superficial aggregations or clumps of lymph nodes, right? And in your neck, I see a group of them right here. And that's why a physician might palpate your neck sometimes to find out if these lymph nodes are infected. Also your armpit, right? If you have a bunch of nodes in your cervical region that are inflamed, well, somebody might be interested to see if the infection is down here in your axillary region. So they might palpate this, right? Or even inguinal region. Look at all of these down over here in the inguinal region. So all of these are proper places to touch, right? If a physician... Right, or healthcare providers trying to understand what the extent of an infection would be. Okay. So it seems kind of inappropriate at times, but that's exactly what they're doing. All right, so the function of a lymph node is to filter lymph, produce lymphocytes, right? We understand that to be activation of the immune system, that's lymphocyte cell division, and lymph nodes also contain macrophages, all right? So not only lymphocyte, but macrophages that were monocytes at one time, and it's called a macrophage. What is phagocytosis? That's what phage stands for. Phagocytosis means cell eating, right? So a macrophage, okay, is one of these white blood cells that have crawled out of the blood into these germinal centers, and they actually engulf antigens, which could be bacteria or viruses, right? And then these macrophages will then present that antigen to some other part of the lymphatic tissue that can, like lymphocytes, that can identify it and produce an immune response. All right, so macrophages sometimes are like a delivery system of antigens in some foreign place of your body. They will bring it to a lymph node so that a lymph node or some other lymphatic tissue can start to design an immune response to that. That usually happens. That's really good. There are macrophages in your lung that do that all the time, constantly, because we're breathing in bacteria and garbage all the time just by breathing. And there is one notable kind of bacteria, right, that if you inhale it, the macrophages will engulf it and bring it to lymphatic tissue deep inside your body, and so that lymphocytes can identify it and start to kill it. But that particular bacteria knows how to hide from lymphocytes. So lymphocytes can't detect that it's there. And what have the macrophages done? They've taken this bacteria that was in your lungs and distributed it through your whole body. So that's a really ingenious way to infect your whole body, is to actually have part of your immune system help deliver that bacteria all over. And that particular bacteria is called anthrax. And that's why anthrax is so different and deadly compared to many other kinds of bacteria that you could inhale, because anthrax has a way of hiding from your immune system. So what they call aerosolized anthrax is a really dangerous kind of thing. You don't ever want to breathe in anthrax, because your immune system, right, helps deliver it everywhere in your body and can't kill it, can't find it. That's kind of sad when that happens. All right, so that's a lymph node. What does a lymph node look like? Here's a lymph node. I see some vessels attached to it, and I see a valve. I see a valve here and here and here, and I see some valves over here. So what kind of vessel could this be? Could these things be arteries? Could these vessels be arteries going to this lymph node right here? And you would say, no, because arteries never have valves, right? Okay, but could this vessel be a vein? And you say, yeah, because veins have valves. Could it also be a lymphatic vessel? And you could say, well, yeah, it could be a lymphatic vessel, because lymph vessels have valves too, right? And so I'll just tell you, these are lymph vessels, lymphatic vessels. They're not veins, but they're very much like veins, because there's very low pressure in here. And lymph can only enter a lymph node from this vessel right here because of the orientation of the valve. When it flows this way, the valve opens. When it tries to flow back, then these places here catch that flow, and it closes these flaps. The flaps close. Okay, and these over here are lymphatic vessels that are taking lymph away from a lymph node. So the ones that bring, okay, lymph into a lymph node are called afferent. Okay, the ones that carry lymph away from a node are called efferent. Right, like neurons that bring sensory information into your brain. What do we call neurons that bring information into your brain? You could call them sensory, but another name is afferent, right? And neurons that take information away from your brain are called efferent, right? And so these vessels are called exactly the same way. So there are some connective tissues. There's a capsule, right, that has some collagen. There's some invaginations into the lymph node. We call those trabeculae. And there are various germinal centers. So here is a germinal center that contains lymphocytes, and lymph filters through all of these different compartments looking for antigens and by those macrophages and lymphocytes. And then after lymph is cleared of those particles, right, then it enters the efferent lymphatic vessel and makes its way further toward the heart. But it might have to go through another lymph node on its way there. Okay, so in the cortex, we have these germinal centers, and we even have germinal centers within the medulla, which is the deeper part, right? But I don't see any septations or these little trabeculae in the medullary part of a lymph node. All right, spleen. Spleen, lymph node. Tonsil, we talked about lymph node, spleen. And a lymph node, the connective tissue holding all of these cells together, is a reticular connective tissue in a lymph node. And what can you tell me about reticular fibers? As a matter of fact, let's think back. How many kinds of fibers did you learn about when we looked at a connective tissue? How many different kinds? Yeah, three, right? Which was the strongest kind of fiber? Collagen, that's right, collagen like a steel cable or Kevlar cable, really, really strong. What's one that's not so strong but has another interesting property? Not as strong, a second kind of elastic fibers. Yeah, they're stretchy, right? So, and they don't get damaged when they stretch as long as you don't overstretch them. And then when that tension is released, they go back to their original length. That's really handy. So it has a little bit different function. Strength is not one of them, but stretchiness is. And then the third kind, what do we call the third kind? The reticular. What's a characteristic of reticular compared to elastic and collagen? Not as strong as collagen, not as stretchy as elastic, right? So it's very weak, but it can hold some organs together that don't experience a lot of trauma or movement, like a lymph node. Right, so the matrix that all these cells are embedded in is a reticular connective tissue, but it's relatively weak. It's easily traumatized. Another organ whose base matrix is reticular is the spleen. All right, so there's no collagen in the spleen, so since it has reticular fibers, it's relatively weak as well. Trauma to the spleen can cause it to rip. Maybe not all the way through, but in certain locations it can rip. And since it's highly vascular, just like this lymph node, okay, because the spleen filters blood, then it produces a hemorrhage and can be a really severe hemorrhage. So one way, when you lacerate your skin and your skin starts to hemorrhage, what would be one way to help your skin heal? Just sew it back together, right? Just sew it back together with a suture. Well, that works really well because your skin has dermis, and the dermis has a lot of collagen fiber. So you can afford to put a suture into the dermis because it's nice and strong and tough. It can be sewn together. Not so for the spleen, because it only has reticular fibers. As soon as you place a suture into the spleen to close a laceration, for instance, then the suture even causes more damage and more bleeding. Right? So in that particular case, that part of the spleen has to be removed. That part, the blood vessel going to that part of the spleen has to be tied off so blood can't get to it, and then that part of the spleen is removed. And in some cases, the whole spleen has to be removed, if that's the case. So when does that happen? No car accidents, any kind of high velocity kinds of impacts. A couple years ago, a really famous football player got hit in the back, and he had a lacerated spleen. I can't remember his name. It will come to me in a little bit. He couldn't play for the first couple games of the football season. Okay, but if it's removed, you still can live pretty much a normal life after that, even though the spleen has some important functions. All right, so let's take a look. We saw that reticular fiber. Spleen. Ah, here's the spleen. Okay, splenic artery, splenic vein, reticular matrix, this area where blood vessels enter the spleen, that's called the hilum. The kidney has a hilum. Okay, so here I see splenic arteries bringing blood into the spleen, and it filters through all of these different spaces that we call splenic cords into venous sinuses, which then return that plasma to capillaries, which then return it to the splenic vein and back to your body. So these different areas of the spleen, okay, here I see a couple different areas. I see an area that's kind of white or not as dark. That's white pulp. And then I see some areas that are a little bit darker. This is what we call red pulp. Well, white pulp are germinal centers, and the job of white pulp is to filter lymph, right, for antigen. So these are almost like lymph nodes inside the spleen. Okay, red pulp is responsible for filtering blood. And when blood filters through red pulp, not only is it looking for antigens, but it's looking for old red blood cells or damaged red blood cells. And then the spleen will get rid of them, and then, of course, they're replaced. Remember, you lose about 1 to 2 million red blood cells every second because they don't live a very long time. But then red bone marrow replaces that many red blood cells so that you don't become anemic. And red blood cells can be, or some parts of a red blood cell can be rebuilt using the byproducts or breakdown products from red pulp. Yeah. White pulp filters lymph. Red pulp filters blood. Also in red pulp, okay, so there are germinal centers in white pulp to fight infection, so spleen's important for fighting infection. And these agents could be in lymph or could be in blood, because that's the job of the spleen. The spleen is important for recycling components of red blood cells so that you don't run out of red blood cells. But the red pulp also can act as a reservoir for red blood cells. So there's a lot of red blood cells in the spleen that are not circulating in your body. And so we call that a reservoir. Because if you ever do have a hemorrhage, right, and lose millions or billions of red blood cells with that hemorrhage, your spleen is able to give up the red blood cells that it has and put them back into your circulatory system, right, to boost up your red blood cell count. Right, so that's why we say it's a reservoir for red blood cells. Okay, and then the last point is, remember that this is only has reticular fibers in there, so it's a relatively fragile kind of organ in your body. And usually I have questions about these different lymphatic tissues because sometimes they have to be removed, like tonsils, for instance, and they're there to fight infection. Spleen, when it's traumatized, it's there to fight infection. Maybe an appendix, which is part of your large intestine, and it contains mold, and its function is to fight infection. Sometimes that gets chronically inflamed like a tonsil and has to be removed. What do we call that infection of a tonsil? We've named what the removal is, a tonsillectomy. What do we call an inflammation of a tonsil? Tonsillitis, yeah. What do we call inflammation of the appendix? Appendicitis, right? Good. Okay, so sometimes when there is a severe inflammation, infection of the appendix, it has to be removed too, and then that lymphatic tissue is removed from your body. So you might ask, well, what's the downside to removing all of that tissue from your body that fights infection? Is somebody more prone to infection when that happens? All right, and here's the answer. You have so much lymphatic tissue all over your body in the form of mulch that when you remove part of that lymphatic tissue, appendix or tonsil, for instance, or spleen, the rest of your immune system can take over and do a pretty good job of fighting infection. So somebody that has those organs removed really are not at any higher risk of infection compared to somebody that has their appendix and tonsil and spleen. With one caveat with the spleen. There are some times in your life, not everybody, but some people, when they have a very high risk of infection. And if you have a very high risk of infection, then when you are missing a spleen, then under certain circumstances, a physician would want to know that and consider that before they do an intervention. Okay? And that condition is when a prosthesis is placed in your body. What's a prosthesis? Something that is unnatural, something artificial, like an artificial knee, for instance, or maybe a mesh to hold different parts of your body together where connective tissue won't hold it together anymore, artificial knee, or maybe a clip put on a blood vessel to keep it from bleeding. Those are all called prostheses. And when somebody has surgery, number one, that they're at a high risk of infection, but they're even at a higher risk, right, if somebody leaves a prosthesis in your body or it's placed there on purpose. Right, so if somebody has a splenectomy, then that has to be entered into the equation and considered. Is that surgery now really helpful to the patient since they're at a very high risk of infection because they don't have a spleen? So only under those rare circumstances does a splenectomy maybe have some kind of clinical consequence. Maybe in lab, I can ask and see if anybody has any special prostheses in their body. Okay. Thymus gland. Oh, here's a tonsil. Again, we can see some germinal centers and tonsils. Thymus gland. It's located in the superior mediastinum. And, oh, here's an overview of some lymphatic tissue. I can see the five tonsils in the oral cavity. Right, I can see the spleen. I can see the appendix. And I can see these aggregated lymphoid nodules in your intestine. And here is the thymus. Right, the thymus is important. It probably has some germinal centers. But what is really happening in the thymus is that there are certain kinds of lymphocytes, right, go to this particular organ to gain competence to fight infection. And that kind of lymphocyte is called a T lymphocyte because what organ do they go to? They go to the T gland or thymus gland, right? So they're T lymphocytes. T lymphocytes, so maturation of T lymphocytes takes place in the thymus, and the job of a T lymphocyte is when it bumps into a bacteria, right, it grabs onto that bacteria and causes it to blow up. We call that, does anybody know what that's called when a cell blows up or breaks apart? That's called lysis, right? When you break something big down into smaller things, that's called lysis. So T lymphocytes will lyse bacteria, will break them apart, and then, of course, they're no longer alive when that happens. And so we call T lymphocytes contact killers, right? And it's kind of handy to remember because there's a lot of T's in contact. And there's a T in thymus, there's a T in T lymphocyte. That's where T lymphocytes go to gain competence. T lymphocyte can't fight infection at a distance. It actually has to bump into a bacteria. There's another kind of lymphocyte that doesn't have to go to the thymus gland, and it can produce compounds that can kill bacteria even at a distance. This kind of lymphocyte doesn't have to touch a bacteria to kill it. Those are called B lymphocytes. B lymphocytes are lymphocytes that can produce antibodies. Antibodies are chemicals in your blood that when they bump into an antigen, it can grab the antigen and then it can lyse the cell as a result of that. So T lymphocytes are contact killers. B lymphocytes produce antibodies, a different way of fighting infection. Right? Antibody production versus contact killing. All right, so that's the lymphatic system. And when you remove some large lymphatic organ like spleen, appendix, tonsil from your body, right, that malt, which is all over, can take over and do a really good job of fighting infection because it's loaded with lymphatic tissue and germinal centers. All right, so that's it for lymphatic system. Not a really long chapter. All right, so let's see what is next. So what is next on the schedule? Respiratory system. Okay, nice. Let's take a quick look at respiratory system before we go up to lab. And here is respiratory system. Okay. All right, let's look at this picture first right here. Here's your respiratory system. And here is your nasal cavity. Here is the oral cavity. The nasal cavity is a passageway for air only, not anything that we eat. Shouldn't go up into the nasal cavity. It can because the oral cavity and nasal cavity are connected together by your pharynx. let me zoom out a little bit. Okay, and a pharynx is this space behind your oral cavity, and it's actually behind the nasal cavity that has a common name. Right? What do you usually call this area behind your mouth? Your throat. I think I heard throat. Yeah. So you could write in throat for pharynx. Right? And that's why that little tube that goes from your throat to the middle ear is called the tympanic tube. Right, because it goes from your throat, and I see the opening right here, up to the middle chamber of your ear to help equalize pressure. Right? So your throat is your pharynx, and that's how we're going to talk about it. So when you get a sore throat, what is the proper medical term for that? It's not appendicitis. It's not a tonsillitis. It's a pharyngitis. A pharyngitis is a sore throat. All right, and then air usually goes down into this tube here. This is the trachea. Trachea is a passageway for air. You shouldn't have anything that you eat or drink in the trachea. And the first part of the trachea is what we call the larynx. And you can actually feel part of the larynx. It's that point in your anterior neck that sticks out. That's a particular cartilage. That is part of the larynx. And in that cartilage, there are things that vibrate when air passes over them, and it produces a sound, and we call those vocal cords. Right? They're located in the larynx. So when you get an inflammation of the larynx and you can't talk or your voice changes drastically, do we call that a pharyngitis? We do not. We call that a laryngitis, right? Because that's where the vocal cords are. They're located in the larynx. Okay. The oral cavity is sort of interesting because it's a passageway for food, but you can also breathe through your mouth because, right, the pharynx is open to both the nasal cavity and the oral cavity. Air passes down through the trachea and it runs down to this bifurcation, and now we no longer call that the trachea. We call that a bronchus. And so there's a left bronchus and a right bronchus. And if I look at this figure, I notice that the right lung looks a lot bigger than the left one. Wow, does that make sense? I would say, yeah, that makes sense. Why does that make sense? Because your heart mostly is on the left side of your body in the thoracic cavity, right? And so your heart is right here. And so we might actually call this little notch right here the cardiac notch in the left lung. And if we look at the lung, I see that the left lung has two lobes. If we look at the right lung, because it's bigger, it has 1, 2, 3 lobes going to it. Okay. So that is pretty much the whole respiratory system, excluding some muscles that are necessary for inspiration. Okay. So the back of your throat, we call the pharynx. Right? The back of your nasal cavity is the pharynx, and the back of the larynx right here is also part of the pharynx, but since they're in different locations, they have some subclassifications, like the nasal pharynx is up behind the nasal cavity, oral pharynx is behind, posterior to the oral cavity, and laryngopharynx is posterior to the larynx, which I see right here. Okay. The larynx and trachea have cartilage in them. They're rings or horseshoe-shaped kinds of structures. Right? So the larynx and the trachea are held open all the time. Right? They never collapse. Right? Here is an esophagus, which is going to take food and what we drink to our stomach. It doesn't have cartilage. Right? So unless food is moving through the esophagus, it closes down. It collapses. Right, so here you have a tube that collapses, so the inner surfaces of the esophagus touch each other when it's not being used. That has some really important clinical significance. Right? The trachea and larynx are held open all the time. The different sides of the walls of the trachea never touch each other because it's held open, never collapses. That has a different kind of clinical significance to it, and both can be pretty deadly. So we need to understand a little bit about that. All right, so we're talking about respiratory system, so let's think about the larynx right here and the trachea. So if we take a particle, and somebody's standing up or sitting up straight like you all are, we take a particle and put it right here in the larynx and let go, what's going to happen to it? Think about shooting pool. a really easy game. All you have to do is get a ball over the pocket, and what happens? It falls into the pocket. Okay? Same thing here. You get a piece of food into the larynx, let go, it's going to fall right into the trachea. And it can get lodged in the trachea, it can even be lodged in the larynx right here, and then the trachea becomes occluded. It's no longer patent. And when the trachea is occluded, what is that person experiencing? Extreme stress, because they can't breathe. Not a good feeling when you can't breathe, right? And so we call that, what do we call that when you can't breathe because you have a particle in this airway? That is called choking, right? And that can result in death relatively rapidly. And since air can't move through the larynx, that can't vibrate the vocal cords. So when you are choking, you can't even say, help, I'm choking, which is terrible, right? Because you need help because you can't breathe. You're going to die. So fortunately, there's a universal symbol or hand gesture that tells everybody that you're choking. And probably everybody should know that. And everybody should show me what that motion is right now. It's like a gang sign. What is it? If you take both hands, put it around your throat like that, and somebody that's kind of educated knows that you're asking for help and that you're choking. Okay. So, and then how would you help somebody? Is anybody CPR certified in here? Probably. So, yeah, number of people CPR certified. Okay, and so then what would you do? You do the Heimlich maneuver, and I think the person that developed that technique is suing somebody because he doesn't want his name associated with it. I don't know what they're going to call it, but anyway, we call it the Heimlich maneuver. You get behind somebody, make a big fist with your two hands, get right underneath the xiphoid process, and yank posteriorly and superiorly at the same time. It's pretty uncomfortable for the patient. But that compresses all the air in the lungs, and hopefully the particle will come shooting out of their mouth. So don't point them in the direction of your instructor when you do that. Okay? So, and if that doesn't help, then you maybe have some other remedies to help the person. That's called the Heimlich maneuver for clearing somebody's airway so that they stop choking. Okay. Well, if you see somebody choking in a restaurant, and they don't give you this sign, and maybe they're starting to turn blue or acting really strange, should you just go up to somebody that you think is choking and perform a Heimlich maneuver on them? Right? Sneak up behind somebody's back, grab them from behind and do that maneuver? No, you should not. Right? Because maybe they're not choking, and then that would be called assault. Right? And you don't want to assault anybody. So be careful when you do that. Make sure you get some kind of confirmation that they actually want your help to do that kind of procedure. Okay. All right, so let's look at this larynx in a little bit more detail. Remember, it's held open all the time. These things that look blue to me, these are cartilage. So we see cartilages in the larynx and in the trachea, none in the esophagus. We'll talk about why the esophagus is dangerous because it closes all the time. Remember, the trachea is dangerous because it's held open all the time. So what prevents food that we eat from getting into the larynx and into the trachea? What we eat needs to find its way into the esophagus. Well, there's a trapdoor, part of the larynx, that closes off the opening into the larynx. And here is something kind of strange. Okay, that opening is called the glottis. It's not a structure. It's like a passageway or a foramen in the larynx. Like your pupil is not a structure, right? It's just a foramen. It's a passageway for light. It's a passageway through the iris. So the passageway for food entering the larynx is called the glottis. When you swallow, okay, this trapdoor right here closes the glottis off. Food slides over this thing into your esophagus. This thing right here, the trapdoor, is nice elastic cartilage. It's very bendable. That is called the epiglottis. What does epi mean? On top, above. And glottis is above that opening to the larynx. Okay, so that trapdoor really works nicely. It's rare that somebody chokes by getting food into the larynx or trachea. But you know what? There's a day of the week that this epiglottis gets a little bit lazy. It doesn't work, doesn't like to work. And there's a time, there's a specific time during the day, an hour or a couple hours during that particular day when the epiglottis gets lazy. And when it gets lazy, then food can enter this airway here and people can choke. So Who knows what day that is? What is one day of the week compared to all others? This epiglottis gets lazy. Mondays. Yeah, that's what I would think too. Okay. Yesterday wasn't too bad. I'm more tired on Tuesday today. I don't know why that is. But it's not. It's not Monday. But that would be a good guess. Because everything is kind of sluggish on Monday. If you've had a good weekend. Okay. A Sunday? Okay. Yeah, it's pretty much just a guess. So I got to tell you, it's Friday. Friday is a really common time for people to choke. And then what time on a Friday? It's not any particular hour. It's at a particular time. So you could set your watch for an alarm. And then look around, see if anybody's choking. Okay. Has anybody ever saved somebody's life by doing a Heimlich maneuver in here? We don't have a really large class, but usually I have one, sometimes two students that have done that, right? So it's pretty common. All right, so what hour on Friday is it very common? It is during happy hour, like 5 o'clock, okay? And what is happy hour associated with? Adult beverage, right? Maybe having some nachos or something. And so people choke when they go out after work with other friends that they work with, right? And share beer, margaritas or something, maybe some nachos, popcorn, shrimp. And they're eating and drinking at the same time, having a really nice time. And maybe you guys will do that on some Friday, right? And you'll get together and so you're chewing on some nachos and you're just about ready to swallow. You're in the process of beginning to swallow and somebody tells a really good joke about your anatomy instructor. Okay? And so what do? Instead of swallowing, you start to laugh. You go, and start to laugh. But when you go, what happens to that stuff that you're about ready to swallow? It goes down into the larynx or trachea here. Okay? And so that's usually associated with adult beverage and a place where people are just having a really good time. That's a good time to pay attention to that. Probably the second most important time would be probably Saturday night too, right? And maybe Sunday night. Somebody said Sunday. You should invite me to some of your parties on Sunday night, okay? Okay. So that's when this epiglottis gets lazy, and you should be educated to know what that Heimlich maneuver is, okay? Because that stuff just falls down in here. Well, it's time almost to go up the lab. So I'm going to stop talking, and next time we'll finish up respiratory system, okay? And we'll talk about some physiology also at that particular time, not just anatomy, but some physiology. Okay, any questions before we take off? We're good?